Philip Hill. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
And Philip is a sculptor and a painter, an artist, I think, by profession. Isn't that right, Phil?
That's right. That's how I spend my time. But I have to add writing to that list of creative activities now.
Well, quite. And I was going to begin by asking you about how that transition, if you like, or addition, perhaps, came into being. Because you've got a book out recently, Phileas Phil, Around the World in 65 Days, about your journeys and your travel adventures. So just say a little bit more, if you would, Phil, about how that came about.
I've been thinking for some time now about writing, and I've made various attempts to write novels. During the journey that I'd made around the world in 65 days, I'd kept a journal. And for a few years now, I've been thinking about writing that story. And I've travelled quite extensively, and so there's a number of journeys that I've made where I have considered writing. Anyway, because of COVID, really, for all of its sins, it actually afforded me some months when I had a block of time that I could spend to focus on something, and I did that in writing. And I started going through my journal and going through my photographs of the journey I'd made, and finally decided to put it all together and to write my book Around the World in 65 Days, my journey without flying.
So did you plan to try and retrace Phileas Fogg's journey, or did it kind of arise in a more natural fashion?
No, it was a clear intention. I had spent a summer reading Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne, and I was hooked. And so I started to do some research to see whether it was even possible to go around the world in 80 days without flying. And it was quite tricky, actually, because in the days of Phileas Fogg, fictional as he was, there were quite a few vessels that were plying the trades across the Atlantic and across the Pacific. I mean, there were ships leaving literally every day because they were much smaller ships than the mega container vessels that we have now. And so when I started researching it, I realized it was actually quite difficult to achieve. So I set about finding a way that I could do that. So I do have Mr. Fogg and Jules Verne to blame for setting me on my way. Having said that, I've travelled extensively over the years. I visited all 7 continents, over 120 countries. So I'm kind of used to putting myself out there as far as travelling is concerned. But this was a step beyond, if you like, because I had a time limit that I was trying to stick to. Yeah. I wanted to try and achieve less than 70 days if I could.
Right, and clearly you did that. You achieved it in 65 days. And so to what extent did it go to plan then, Philip? I'm really interested to know, given I imagine that you put quite a lot of time into planning and researching, did it go according to plan?
Well, here's the funny part of it, Julia. I probably didn't do anywhere near as much planning as I should have done. And I got myself into hot water, definitely on one occasion, on a couple of occasions, I would say. So I should have planned a little better than I had. And quite early into my journey, I managed to get myself deported from Belarus, which wasn't really very clever.
How did that come about, Philip?
I was on a train travelling from Berlin to Moscow, and I'd got to the Polish-Belarusian border, and I didn't have a transit visa, but I did have a ticket for the Trans-Siberian Railway. And so initially I was stamped free, but my passport was okay, and because I had the ticket from Moscow. And if you read day 3 of my book, you'll realize what a nightmare I went through for the next 48 hours.
Oh, dear.
So, a bit more planning, and I might have realized I needed that transit visa.
Right.
As it happens, I didn't. And, the horror of that day lives on in my memory as one of the most defining moments of my journey. I nearly turned back, to be honest, at that point. But having got through it, I could say the rest of it was a breeze afterwards, although it wasn't quite. But It was an adventure, that's for sure.
Yes, gosh. So did you find yourself, in a cold, dark cell somewhere, or was it not quite as awful as that?
It wasn't quite that bad, but there was a point at which I was in a minibus with 8 fully armed soldiers being driven off in the middle of a cold, snowy night in Belarusia to an unknown destination. And thinking that I was in a Len Deighton spy novel, like the Ypres file, which is now coming out on BBC.
Yeah.
And it was really that kind of situation. Having read enough of those kind of books from Deighton and John le Carrier, I just felt as if I was living it at that moment. Mm. I was my pain sitting in that minibus with those soldiers. It was a really sort of bizarre moment of the journey.
Mm.
I got myself into a few silly situations, which were mostly my own doing. They weren't the most defining, I guess, of the whole journey. I think the trip across the Pacific Ocean probably was.
Really? Why was that? Why was that a defining moment? Or
I found myself in a bit of a strange situation. The only way I could cross the Pacific at that time of year was in a cargo vessel, and I'd managed to book a cabin. There weren't many. There was only 2 or 3. I was the only passenger on this massive 280-metre-long cargo ship, which took over 20 days to cross. And it was a really solitary experience. You really don't have much connection to, or interaction, I should say, with the crew or the officers. So it was really a lonesome time, let's say.
Mm.
And it filled me with so many different emotions. And I always tell people that I found my peace of mind out there on the Pacific Ocean.
Oh.
And it did, and it stayed with me, and it's the thing that stayed with me the most since I returned from that journey.
Gosh, mm. How interesting. So it must have been a little bit like sort of being in solitary confinement or something. What did you do to sort of pass the time and, get something out of it, I guess?
Yeah, I realised quite early on that I would have to set myself some kind of a routine that would get me through every day. And so I did quite a bit of exercise. The weather was good. It's the Pacific, so it was calm. Unlike the Atlantic, which I was on then, on the second sort of ocean part of my journey, which was stormy the whole way and was a disaster. But on the Pacific, it was really calm, so I would walk around the deck, which, it was about 600 metres, the circuit of the deck.
Yeah.
So I could do quite a bit of walking. I did some exercising, I did some studying, wrote my journal.
Yeah.
And lots of reading. And just tried to fill my days. It was a bit, it looked like being institutionalised. I remember I'd spent a time in my younger years in hospital. And, everything was sort of governed by the meals whenever the meals came. And in a way, it was a bit like that on the boat. I can imagine, although I don't want to really think about it too much, that a prison was like that.
Yeah.
It's you become institutionalized to the place where you are.
Yeah.
Having said that, I look back on the whole of my journey around the world, and there were mostly highs, very few lows. But the two ocean crossings were something, I can't say I'd want to live through them again, but I certainly wouldn't have wanted to have not made
right.
them.
Yeah, so an incredible experience, but not necessarily one that you would want to repeat. And how important was music to you? I mean, I'm thinking particularly at a time like that, when you were kind of, inside yourself a bit.
It's very important. As we know, music can transport us to different places and different times in our life and different eras. And I listened to music throughout my journey around the world. And I'd play different music depending on what kind of mood I needed to be in.
Mm.
So a lot of the time that I was on the Pacific, for example, it was quite reflective music. I'd be playing things like Marvin Gaye's What's Going On.
You know you've got to find. Relax, don't you ask.
So, you know, there was, the music was always having an impact on me. And strange enough, when I was writing the book, I was also playing the music, a lot. In the, and that was also, it was creating a kind of a mood for me to get into the flow of writing. And, and you know, people have told me it's very difficult to write, but I have to say I found it relatively easy. And I got into a flow, and I wrote this book in 3 months, and I've already started writing my second book.
Right.
And I have a number of other books lined up that I can write as well.
So you've got...
So I would often have music blaring away in the background or calming me down when I needed it. So, yeah. And I make a number of references to music in the book as well, and to modern culture and to movies, for example.
So, you've mentioned a couple of the tricky bits, the lows, as it were. What in your sticks out in your memory as, you know, high points or most interesting points? What would you say were some of the things that you, you know, that were highlights for you, I guess?
Yeah, I think that quite often the times which we think are the lows at the time, afterwards when we reflect, become the highs. So, for example, the journey across Poland, which was a nightmare at the time, afterwards I reflected on it as high. And times which were highs, so for example in Mexico City, I had, what shall we call it, a romance. Which at the time seemed a high. But afterwards, on reflection, I realised it was quite a low. So,
intriguing, intriguing. So what about Poland then? So what was tricky about travelling across Poland?
Well, I was travelling all through the night, and I'd spent, I got myself somehow into a carriage with seven young chaps who were completely drunk out of their heads. And I was trying to make four train connections through the night, and it just seemed like the journey from hell. It made the trip in the minibus with the Belarusian guards seem quite easy, actually. But to go back to your point about what were the highs, you know, one of the biggest highs I've always had when I've been travelling is the people that I meet. And whilst there were really solitary times on this entire journey, there were also blocks of time where I did get to meet a lot of people. So, for example, I took a train from Los Angeles to Chicago, and it was a sleeper train. And it was inclusive of meals. So whenever I went to the dining car, I was put on, as a single person, I was put on a table with other people. And I met a whole variety of people, people that I would never have come into contact with. So, for example, on two occasions, I was with people from the Amish community. Well, I would never ordinarily, I guess, speak to people from the Amish community. I mean, we don't have any in England. But, I mean, even in America, I wouldn't have come into contact with them. But it was fascinating to sit with them and, you know, hear their views. I also met lots of people along the way that, you know, were very helpful to me and pointing me in the right direction. And they're just, you know, good company, basically.
Yes, yes. I can empathise with that. I've done a couple of those sort of 24-hour trips on American trains where you go to the diner car and get fed. And in fact, the last time I did it, I was travelling with a bunch of people who were on their way to a Lego conference. Can you believe it? A Lego
there
conference.
Yeah. And I bet none of them were Danish.
They weren't. No, they were definitely American. Yes, I mean, absolutely fascinating. You mentioned a moment ago, Philip, a romance in Mexico City. Can you give us any more of a glimpse into that? And does it feature in your book?
I wondered if you'd come back to that. It does feature in my book. But the funniest part of that story is that a few years later, this romantic element managed to track me down where I live in Greece part of the year. Totally unexpected. I didn't know that she was arriving. And the consequences of that, which are well documented in the book, I think some may find hilarious. To me at the time, they were a nightmare.
Oh, really? Oh, no.
But, you know, in the kind of nicest way of being a nightmare. But it was a really, you know, so I'd gone from meeting this person in Mexico City to the next time I saw her, she was in a Greek island.
Yes.
She actually came from Turkey.
Gosh.
So, you know, travelling the world, you know, my journey followed me home in a way.
Yes.
Well, but nothing more came, I have to say, Julia, nothing more came of that situation.
Oh, I was after kind of hoping, visit, I was kind of hoping it was going to be...
No, I never married her and never went any further. And my little dog who got lost on the day that she arrived on the island is very responsible for a lot of what came afterwards.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I have to say, we're obviously going to have to
read
the book.
Yes. That one, I'm afraid.
Absolutely. So are you doing any promotions in Bath for your book, Phil?
Well, I've contacted quite a few different bookshops in Bath, and it really is on my agenda to take that a bit further with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm spending some time right now in Devon. I'm doing some book readings and book launch in Totnes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have to get my act together in Bath as well and make more people aware of
And yes, because you're in Bath much of the time, and presumably, do you show your artwork in Bath?
Most of my artwork I actually sell in Greece. I moved up to Bath last year, so a lot of what I was selling was in Devon.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say, I kind of put my sculpture, which is light sculpture, which I make with plexiglass. I kind of put that on hold while I was writing this book.
Mm.
And I know that this spring, summer, I've really got to get my act together and start producing some work. I don't have anything left to sell, basically.
Mm.
So I know I'm going to. I'm just a little bit, not nervous, but I've really got into writing mode.
Mm.
So I can't do all of these things at once. So I am wondering whether or not the... especially my painting will get put on hold. I think I'll always produce the light sculpture that I make.
Yes.
But I'm really keen now to see how far this book can get recognised.
Yes.
And move on and you know, further my second book.
Yes. It sounds
all out comedy.
It sounds like you've been bitten by the writing bug.
I have.
And what's your second book then? You said you've got another one in the works or planned.
I made a journey around Europe for about 2 months with a friend of mine from Greece, and we only stayed with people that we'd met over the years on the little island, you know, where he lives. He's got a farm and a vineyard. I've got a house there. And we only ever stayed with people that we've met. And we just got ourselves into the most ludicrous, even in London, ludicrous and funny situations.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to tell the book from my point of view, but as this friend of mine, his name is Kostas, is completely crazy, I'm going to also tell it from his point of view as well. Because the book that I've just released, Around the World in 65 Days, is an anecdotal book. It's not meant to be a diary or a travel guide.
Right.
It tells the story of my journey, but it tells it from an anecdotal point of view. So
yeah.
Things that happened and things that happened. And so the second book is very much going to be like that. And what might be an event that happened in London? So, for example, we got into a little bit of trouble, there wasn't really major fisticuffs or anything involved. But my friend Costa claims that he had a fight with Prince Harry. Well, we all know that he didn't have a fight with Prince Harry, but whenever I hear him telling the story of the event that happened, it was a fight with Prince Harry. So you can see how he's taken situations which were way out of the realm of being reasonable. So when I tell that story of the journey around Europe, there will be two versions of every event that took place.
Well, that sounds like quite an intriguing perspective. It sounds like you were sort of sofa surfing around Europe, basically.
We pretty much were, yes. We were. We covered a reasonable number of countries and spent a lot of time in Italy, I would say France, but Italy is the biggest time that we spent. And it was from the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, one evening we were staying with a film director at his swanky pad in Rome. And the next day we were in Tuscany and staying in an old farm, you know. So
yeah.
We were eating and no hot water. So,
do you know, it sounds like you have such a fun life, Philip.
I can't complain. I don't think there's anyone I know that I would swap my life with.
Yeah. Well, that is a fantastic thought. And just one more thought or question, really. So do you have any more journeys planned? Have you got anything sort of lined up that you're looking to do now that, you know, COVID is kind of under control?
Well, the one I would have made had COVID not come, which is one that I'm still planning to do, is Polynesia. I really need to get myself out to all of those islands out there between Hawaii and Australia.
Mm.
That's quite a big trip that I'm planning. But I also made a decision that, and I made this just before COVID came, and my first attempt, which was completely thwarted by COVID, was to spend 2 months in Tuscany, where I plan to go and stay and live for those 2 months and paint. And then exhibit and sell my work and try to just live off of that. And I plan to do that in a number of different countries. So every year I was planning 2 months in a country, fully immersing myself in the country that I was in and the place that I was staying, and working and then selling my work.
So yeah.
Tuscany was first, Denmark was going to be second, and Scotland was going to be third. So I've still got my plans.
To go to
Tuscany and spend those 2 months there. And it struck me as I was writing this book last year, the Around the World in 65 Days, that it would be interesting to write about those experiences of those 2 months in each of those different places that I stayed.
Yes, yeah. Well, I have to say that does sound like fun. It's slightly reminiscent of Simon Armitage's walking trips, where he takes no money and relies on, like an old-fashioned bard, going around telling stories and getting paid, in inverted commas, for his stories and living off people's hospitality, really, and curiosity.
That's my plan, but to do it with paintings.
Yes.
Because I couldn't really take all my sculpture. I can paint.
Well, I have to say that...
Hopefully sell the paintings and pay for my supper.
That sounds brilliant, and I wish you every success with it, and look forward to seeing some of that down in print.
I hope you will one day. And I can come back on and tell you all about it.
Yes, absolutely brilliant. Great to talk to you, Philip, and good luck with your next journey.
Thank you. Pleasure speaking with you.
Bringing the city to you. You are listening to Bath Radio.